You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Taylor, and today got a bit of a mixed bag for you. I'm pulling something out of the vault, but I'm also going to share some other newer stuff at the end of the hour. So as you may know, today is Human Rights Day. It's the 70th anniversary of Human Rights Day. It's the anniversary of the signing of the International Declaration of Human Rights, which is a document we'll talk about a little more at the end of the show. Human rights is kind of a seemingly simple subject. And then when we get into the nitty gritty, and especially if you read through that full document, which I'll do a condensed version at the end to the best of my ability, you'll start to see some pretty clear disconnects with what we might be experiencing in our day-to-day lives in this country and in other countries around the world. So it's an interesting topic. It's aspirational, to be sure. I'm going to share a little bit about that. I also want to give a brief update here at the top of the show, particularly for local listeners. The last 2 weeks, I've been focusing on the activism led by people experiencing homelessness and their advocates here in Spokane at Camp Hope at City Hall. If you haven't heard the news, yesterday the SPD went in following a large-scale protest the day before, where many supporters chained themselves around the camp to show their support after eviction notices were delivered to the camp. Yesterday, Sunday, two arrests were made of folks who have been supporting the camp for supposed obstruction of justice when they were following the instructions by police to help clear the possessions from the camp. A prison work crew from Geiger did the dirty work of sweeping up people's belongings and putting them into a compactor truck. Some of the possessions were salvaged by the people whose stuff it was and also by supporters, but that's still kind of a developing story. I just wanted to give an update on it since we've been talking about it for 2 weeks. You might be coming here for updates. And tonight, in just about an hour at 5 o'clock, at City Hall, there is a support rally for Camp Hope for the future of this action that's been ongoing. So there's also a call to have folks sign up for open forum to testify at City Council. So if that's your thing, if you're feeling fired up, you can head down there pretty soon. So I just wanted to open up with that invitation and that information for all of the listeners out there. And again, the best place to go might unfortunately be Facebook. There's a group on there, Camp Hope Spokane. You can look up, you can email me at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S at KYRS.org as well. And I can try my best to help you get connected. So, changing course completely from that, almost completely. The overarching theme is obviously human rights. I was thinking about the archive of shows because this is finals week for me and I'm a little behind on pulling new things together. And the first thing that came to mind was this great interview from a couple years ago when Loretta Ross was the keynote speaker at International Women's Day, and I was able to interview her. So you'll hear about her in this interview I'm about to play. She's done a ton of work really pioneering this concept of reproductive justice, which, in her view, she looks at all of her work that she does through a human rights lens. We discussed that in the interview. And I also thought reproductive justice was an interesting topic for today, given the interesting Supreme Court decision to kind of back up Planned Parenthood in some ways. I'm suspicious. I'm glad about it. Ultimately suspicious. Anyway, without getting too derailed on that, I'm going to play that interview with Loretta Ross. I'll be back on toward the end of the hour to talk a little more about the Declaration of Human Rights in general, what we are doing this Human Rights Day, and a little history for you. So enjoy this interview, and thanks for listening.
you wouldn't mind starting just by introducing yourself, saying a little bit about who you are and how you ended up doing the work that you do.
Okay, my name is Loretta Ross. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I am the former national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective. And I ended up doing the work that I do because I was a rape survivor, and I was lucky enough to become the third executive director of the very first rape crisis center in the country in the 1970s. So I've been kind of like a professional feminist or human rights activist ever since.
Wow. So you founded Sister Song, and you also founded the National Center for Human Rights Education. And
yes, my
My
transition went from women's rights to civil rights to human rights. And so I've also monitored hate groups and dealt with a number of other issues, but feel that now's our time to build a united human rights movement, bringing all the different issues together.
Yeah, and could you, for people who aren't familiar, I kind of want to define a couple things when we talk today. The idea of reproductive justice, which is a concept that you were integral in building, but also in understanding what a human rights organizing framework looks like. So,
okay,
whichever one makes the most sense for you to tackle first.
Okay. First of all, reproductive justice really isn't that hard to describe. It's just hard to achieve. Well, we go beyond the pro-choice framework because we've joined it in fighting for the right not to have kids, and all individuals have the right to use birth control or abortion or abstinence if they can hold on. But we go beyond the pro-choice movement because as women of color, we have to fight equally hard for the right to have our children, to have the children that we want to have and under the conditions under which we want to have them, which means using midwives or doulas or avoiding forced cesareans, for example. Hmm. And then the third tenet of reproductive justice is the right to raise our children in safe and healthy environments. And, of course, this brings us into conversation with the other movements like the Black Lives Matter movement, or the environmental justice movement, or the anti-gentrification movement. So reproductive justice is kind of like that promiscuous concept that will sleep with anything that affects an individual's right to control their own sex and sexuality, determine if they want to have children, how they want to see their children thrive. It goes way beyond the stale debate on abortion.
Mm-hmm. And that brings up my biggest frustration with, you know, the anti-abortion movement that likes to call itself pro-life, because they appear very unconcerned with those conditions, with health access, with education access, safe neighborhoods, good food, once children exist.
Yeah, they seem to not care about the kids and once they're here.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's not just the right to control your own fertility, but quite often, those external conditions even determine whether or not you're ready to parent or not. Because a lot of people want to make sure that they have a good environment for their children, health care, that they have jobs, that they have educational opportunities. And if those things are lacking, that may dissuade someone from keeping a wanted pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And so we believe reproductive justice is a much more logical and human rights-based approach to looking at these issues and really focusing on individuals' human rights so that they can express their sex and their sexuality in the way that's most comfortable for them.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful framework, I think. What does it look like on the ground? What does it look like as a movement? What has it looked like, and what is it looking like in the future?
Well, first of all, let's talk about what human rights are, because usually when people think about human rights, they think about the tortured prisoner in a jail OC somewhere. But human rights are really our own deal with our own government. I mean, there's civil rights, the right to be equal to anybody else in society, political rights like freedom of speech, the right to vote. Though we don't have our right to have our votes counted, so says the Supreme Court. economic human rights, which is what the Occupy movement has called attention to, that the economy is definitely being managed for the benefit of the 1%, not the 99%. So we have a right to living wage. We have a right to economic benefits of our society. We're the richest country in the world, but most of us are not benefiting from that. And I think that's what's animating a number of people to support somebody like Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's social human rights, which is about your human needs, your right to food, shelter, education, health care, cultural human rights, which of course is your right to practice the religion of your choice. So freedom of religion is a human right. But we as feminists also maintain that freedom from religion is a human right. I have the human right to not have someone else's religion imposed upon my body.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, it kind of frustrates me because so many of these proselytizers for religion can't even get the people of their own faith to obey them. And then they're trying to make the rest of us go along with the program. And then there's environmental human rights, the right to clean water, non-toxic neighborhoods. Those are very important rights, you know, the right to a clean environment. And then developmental rights is the one that's harder to describe. But what we used to call the developing world or the third world is now called the global south. And they're demanding the right to control their own natural resources. And really are protesting our willingness to go to war to secure their oil for our own uses. And then the eighth category is called sexual human rights, which is, of course, one of my favorites because it's about the right to determine if and when you have sex, if and when you marry, if and when you have kids, and, of course, the right to sexual pleasure. And so when, because reproductive justice rests on this capacious human rights framework, we feel that it goes far beyond arguing for privacy, because some things the government must not do to us, like tell us how to worship or tell us how to vote or tell us what to say. But at the same time, government has an obligation to us to provide a health care system, an educational system, an economic system where we can find jobs, those kinds of things. Sexual rights are called negative and positive rights in human rights parlance. But basically, we feel that we should use the global human rights framework in the United States, bring human rights home.
Yeah, and where, this is kind of a leading question, where do you think we're at in terms of the United States? How close are we to that in this country today?
Well, we're pretty far away from it because of the more than 2 dozen human rights treaties that are available to be ratified by the Senate, and it only takes a 2/3 majority of the Senate, not the Congress, but the Senate, to ratify a treaty. We've only ratified 3 of 26 treaties. And so we practice what's called American exceptionalism. We believe that we're too good to live by the rules that the rest of the world lives by, which is a bit arrogant on our part, probably a lot of arrogant on our part. So, for example, we have not ratified the Women's Human Rights Treaty, the Children's Human Rights Treaty, the environmental treaties, the Weapons of Mass Destruction treaties. I mean, there's so many things we just refuse to do for a legitimate fear, because once we do those things, then Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution says that treaty law is the same as federal law. So mm-hmm. if we ratified these treaties, we have to change our laws to comply with them. And so the Senate is very stubborn in failing to ratify international treaties because they don't want to be compliant with them. But I think they do a disservice to the American people. And we're out of step with the international human rights community, even though we brazenly use the phrase that we're a human rights-based country. But in many ways, we're failing our people in terms of protecting their human rights, whether it's access to a free education or universal health care, or just even having the economy managed so that jobs aren't being outsourced, that we don't just have minimum wage jobs, living wage jobs. But the problem we have is that the American people as a whole don't know their human rights. And if you don't know your human rights, you can't fight for your human rights. And so I actually think it's a conspiracy that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is over 60 years old, and most of the American public has never even heard of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even as an activist and someone who's been engaged in this world, I wasn't exposed to it for many years, you know, after I probably should have been being in that world, let alone just in normal life. And there's even, I wonder, there's something I wanted to ask you about a little bit later on, but how do you think we can approach, just in our culture, there's a big, loud, noisy movement on the right that says, basically, you don't have a right to anything. You're not born with a right to anything. You're not entitled. You know, how do you engage that and kind of clarify that for people in a way that's effective?
Well, I'm not so sure they're opposed to human rights. They just want to reserve them for a small part of the population themselves. I love it when they say we want to keep the government out of our Medicare. It's just amazing that they understand that they deserve entitlements and benefits, but they tend to accuse anybody who's not just like them, meaning white, heterosexual, Christian, etc., as undeserving of human rights, as if we're not human or something. So I don't know if these people that I'm talking about have ever been exposed to the concept of universal human rights, or if they have just been seduced into a narrative that says that they're the makers of America and we're the takers of America, because that's what the Republicans have been droning in their heads for the last 50 years. And so, and of course, the election of President Obama just confirmed for them that they were losing white privilege in their own society, which is not true, but that's what they believe. So they're using the politics of anger and the politics of rage. And you're seeing it erupting violently at Trump rallies, and the openness of the racism and the homophobia and the sexism in a way that I think some of us are surprised by in the 21st century, because we like to think that we had buried some of that stuff in the 20th century. We certainly fought a civil war over racial equality, and yet we still seem to be fighting that same war over and over and over again. And so I don't try to speak to the leaders of the hate movement, and I consider, you know, Donald Trump one of those leaders, mm-hmm. but I am concerned about his followers, because I think there are people who are damaged by our neoliberal economy who are being left out of the benefits of America. And they're taking their grievances out on other victims instead of seeing how the whole system is rigged to disenfranchise them, to exploit their unemployment and their labor, and to keep us all down. And all we can do is try to call them in to our understanding of how we need to unite to turn the situation around.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted. That was my favorite part. I was at your talk in Spokane on International Women's Day, and was just scribbling furiously, because I loved what you said about calling in instead of calling out. Just as a, you know, movement person, it can be really divisive just among people who you would think would be on the same side. So could you maybe summarize that idea for listeners about calling in versus calling out, what you mean by that?
Well, if we're going to build this united human rights movement, we're going to have to bring people together who don't necessarily agree together, but they agree to be together. That, to me, is really important. If I think working on women's issues is the most important thing to do, and you think working on the environment or voting rights or youth issues or LGBTQ issues, then we can still all sit at the table. And I could be the women's wing of the human rights movement, while you're the queer rights wing of the human rights movement and the environmental justice wing of the same movement. So if we share the human rights framework, we can call each other in instead of calling each other out for not being politically or racially or sexually or ethnically in the same place as we are. It is busting apart the whole concept of identity politics that is being misused to only develop kinship networks, not actually talking about what we have in common as human beings.
Yeah, absolutely. And then that extends even in, I would think that we would kind of have to start at home, as it were, start with people who are already on more of the same page, moving that way, and then reach out a little further.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so, because what happens a lot in progressive circles is that, I think it's typified by the Hillary Sanders split, mm-hmm. how we call each other out for not agreeing with us on which candidates to support, instead of realizing that at some point we're going to have to unite to keep the forces of fascism down. But some people would rather lose and be what they think is right than win if they have to compromise. That's what the Republicans have done for the last two administrations to Obama, and I don't think the left profits from embarking on that same kind of self-destructive strategy.
Mm, yeah, and how, when there is such, there are still legitimate divides there, right, in understanding and everything, how do you think we start to introduce this kind of framework, or how have you started to introduce it in sectors of the movement that you've worked in, when we're pretty far from that in some ways?
Right now I'm organizing the Calling Out Culture Forum up here in the Pioneer Valley, involving the schools of Hampshire College, Smith College, Amherst, Mount Holyoke, and the University of Massachusetts, so that 150 students learn techniques on how to call each other in. And the techniques are not that hard to learn. Like, if you hear somebody use a word that you don't agree with, like, oh, that's retarded, you can approach that person privately and say, you know, when you use that word retarded, I don't necessarily agree with the word, because now we say mentally disabled and you may have inadvertently hurt somebody. But calling out is a public performance where you're condemning somebody for not using the right word and not using the right pronoun or not having the same position that you have on any number of issues. Where calling in is more of a private act, where you do it one-on-one. You try to interrogate what they meant by what they said, whether or not you could offer them a new understanding of what they meant to say, or you could just accept that they meant what they said and be okay with that. Because it's not, again, putting pressure on people to agree with each other, but seeing what you have in common so that you can be with each other. And so much of our radical consciousness has been translated into rude behaviors, which is really antithetical to building a human rights movement. Because the only qualification for being in a human rights movement that you have is to be human. And so I'm not saying that we have to give passes to people who abuse us or commit violence against us, because that should be called out. But at the same time, we can't define every offense we experience as violence. So somebody used the wrong word. Well, that's just them using the wrong word. That's not violence. That's not a trigger. That's not a microaggression. That's just them using the wrong word. And so we have to shift our consciousness and say, first of all, what is our prize? Let's keep our eyes on the prize. We want to build a human rights movement. That's going to require us to call people in and sit down and have respectful conversations about our differences that can unite us versus using those differences to divide us. That's a new strategy for organizing that I don't think we have a lot of experience in, but in 1968, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King called on us to build a human rights movement, but he was assassinated 4 days later. Mm-hmm. And so we're just now getting to the understanding of what will that actually mean. Can we all sit down at the table, even though we're working with different understandings from different identity places, with different politics, but understand that the state of the earth is at risk, the state of our country is at risk, and mostly the state of our friends and our families are at risk, and we really need to do something different. Right now, we don't even know how to have a respectful conversation with the drunk uncle at Thanksgiving who says something that says that he's a Trump supporter. you know, without blowing up the entire Thanksgiving dinner with their opinion about what's wrong with Donald Trump.
Ooh, yeah.
I mean, there's things we can do better if we become more humble, if we recognize that people are entitled to their opinions no matter how wrong they are, and that you can use love as a way to call people in rather than anger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that takes so much personal inner work that I think has been rejected by a lot of people because it sounds really fluffy. You know, it sounds like this kind of new age, like, oh, you know, change yourself. But a lot of that has been cast by the wayside, and I think it has value, you know, to...
But I don't think it's so new age, because in the 1960s, Reverend Dr. Joseph Lowery, who's an icon of the civil rights movement, and maybe I have an advantage because I'm in Atlanta, the birthplace of civil rights, so I get to hear my elders talk all the time. And Reverend Lowery said, we need to learn how to turn to each other instead of on each other. And he said that in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's new age. I think that's the way you craft a winning coalition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I just think the way that it's been presented at times, people think, oh, that doesn't sound strategic. That doesn't sound... And it's also, you know, this is me coming out of somewhere that's really overwhelmingly white, really has a lot of those institutional behaviors and beliefs that are built out of that and are built out of individualism and all of that. So hearing things like that, people think, that's not going to work, you know. So I think we're coming back around.
I get that, but they learned the wrong lessons from the civil rights movement and from the women's rights movement. I mean, the women's movement is not everybody being in the same organization with groupthink. The women's movement is a lot of different organizations with as many definitions of feminism as there are feminists. But at the same time, we're a movement because we have many different ideas moving in the same direction. Whereas if you have one idea moving in the same direction, you're a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not trying to build a cult, but we're using cult-like behaviors when we call each other out. We're not using movement-building behaviors. And so I think as an elder in the movement, I have a rare opportunity to offer insight from my elders and pass it on.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that hopefully makes sense. Now, I do love Gloria Steinem's quote when somebody asked her when she was going to pass the torch. She said, get your own torch. I'm still using mine. And so that's kind of how I feel. I still have work to do with my own torch, but I am very willing to build that bridge and pass on the hard-earned learnings that I've gotten, both from my elders and from 45 years of doing this movement work.
Mm-hmm. And I love talking to people like you are my favorite people to talk to on this show who have that experience, but then are still engaged, who aren't, you know, you're not detached from it now, reminiscing about the old days, you're still in it. And I wonder, what are your observations about kind of the intergenerational dynamics of what's going on right now? What do you see in this up and coming generation that's good? And maybe what advice would you have for what we haven't quite got figured out yet?
Okay, well, what I see is good is that younger people have advantages that will really lend themselves towards building this human rights movement. First of all, they're almost preternaturally intersectional. They delight in having multiple identities that they keep together within their souls, so they're not going to be sliced into the women's movement or the queer movement or the disability rights movement. They want to be all those things at the same time. Well, that's a perfect platform for which to talk about human rights, because we have to build a movement where you can be all those things at the same time rather than being simply identity-based formations. The other advantage they have is technology, the way that they're able to use social media to reach unprecedented numbers and to do mobilizations and to pass on consciousness in a way that we didn't have. I mean, we had print, we had newspapers and radio shows, but certainly without the reach of the current social media. So they have that advantage. I think a disadvantage that they have is that, number one, I think the media tells them that somehow they don't need to listen to elders because we're old school, we don't understand their reality, almost as if we've never been young, you know? And so the media foments quite a bit of intergenerational angst that I think is just unnecessary. I also think that in a way, they have conflated things like abuse, offense, violence, and triggers. They can't necessarily accurately assess a threat level, so that when something offends them, they think by definition it means violence. Well, no, violence has its own characteristic, and it usually involves a physical dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone says something that's offensive to me, I'm going to respond differently than if someone threatens my life. But somehow that gets conflated for young people, so that if someone disagrees with them, you just raped my consciousness. No, I challenge your consciousness. But to use an overly strong word like rape means that, first of all, you don't actually know what rape is. And secondly, that you're over-dramatizing what is actually just a philosophical or political difference. And so I want them to be able to assess threat levels better, because we do have real enemies out here in the personification of Trump followers and Donald Trump in particular, and even, you know, some of the more mild-mannered, mild-seeming people who are opposed to human rights. And so we need to understand that from the 60s and the COINTEL program, one of the things that they used to disrupt radical movements was the performance of calling each other out.
Hmm.
They would gossip about each other. They would, you know, disagree on philosophical points and then oust people for not agreeing with them, and isolate people and really become quite cultish in their behaviors because of that external threat of being infiltrated by the state. Well, right now, we really have to become much more sophisticated in analyzing these threat levels. Otherwise, we become even more vulnerable to being disrupted by the forces that are hostile to what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
We need to learn to call each other in so that we can accurately identify people who refuse to be called in because they're there for a whole nother reason.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, because that's what I've been doing this show for 4 years, talking to people about doing social justice, organizing, and what works specifically. And over the last couple of years, it's really been moving toward this idea of vulnerability, being expressive, being authentic, being open, which is all of what you're talking about, which is why I wanted to talk to you. Do you think that there is a risk that opens up when you make your movements transparent and open and vulnerable in that sort of way and not cultish? You know, if it was developed as a protective armor, do we still need that? And what do you think, there's a downside? I'm not saying that there is, but...
Well, obviously, we become much more vulnerable as we become much more transparent, but we also become much more authentic when we become transparent. I think that there are risks to doing coalitional work because you're going to have to be brave, you're going to have to speak up, you're going to have to move out of your comfort zone. But let's be clear, if being oppressed is not safe, why do we think fighting oppression should be safe?
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense, because we're up against some of the most inimical forces in the world trying to end this sea of oppression, this toxic sea of oppression that we all swim in. And so it requires a different kind of bravery, and it may not be something everybody's ready to do, because if you're in the midst of your trauma, you know, you may not be in an emotional space so that you can work to call somebody in. You may need healing before you can get there. So it's not for everybody, But those of us who have processed our trauma and want to use it as ammunition for building a movement, I do believe that we have an opportunity to build a new movement for the 21st century. I would like to see the 21st century to be the century of human rights and not the century of war. We had that in the 20th century, and I am so ready to get over the Civil War and all the Cold War and culture wars and just move into how can we use the benefits of our planet and our technology and our knowledges to build a better future for humanity. Mm-hmm. That's what I really want us to do. And that's not kumbaya. I think that's survival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Loretta, thank you so much for joining me. Keep up the good
work. Okay, and
thank
you. Send me a tape of your program, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
All right, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Taylor. That was an old, as you might have picked up from some of the context, what we were talking about, older interview with Loretta Ross, awesome advocate for reproductive rights, human rights, reproductive justice, all of the good things. So, yeah, if you missed the top of the show, it's Human Rights Day, hence the old interview out of the vault. It's the 70th Human Rights Day today. A lot has happened in those 70 years. And I want to talk a little bit about what that declaration itself says. So let me pull this up real quick. And yeah, it's not something I ever remember really learning about in a formal context until a few years ago. And I'm not going to read the whole thing to you because there's a lot of whereases. It's a declaration after all. Something that's interesting to know about the Declaration of Human Rights as people who live in the United States is that when it was put together after World War II and then signed in 1948, the U.S. was very involved in the creation of the Declaration and kind of in just a lot of like human rights framework in general, but it took very little time, like talking about less than a decade, for the U.S. to really distance ourselves from that framework. And, you know, it's not that this declaration is like a binding legal document. I think the world would look a lot different if it were. And any human rights law that exists in our context is ratified through local, state, and federal laws. So, I guess as I go through these, you'll see what I mean. And, yeah, we can talk about some of the disparity there. So, yeah, I'm just going to read some of these because it's interesting information to know, as we think about what kind of world we want to try to build in our movements and our lives and all of that. So, skipping the intro. Whereas. Article 1. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in the spirit of brotherhood. Article 2. Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. Furthermore, no distinction shall be made on the basis of the political, jurisdictional, or international status of the country or territory to which a person belongs, whether it be independent, trust, non-self-governing, or under any other limitation of sovereignty. 3. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. I've heard a similar one of those before. 4. No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. 5. No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. Side note on that one. One example that gets brought up for cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment is the death penalty, something we talked about on this show for a long time. Haven't mentioned that Washington State did become one of the states that has overturned use of the death penalty. And actually in Washington State, importantly, part of the reason that it was is that it was found to be given out in a racially biased manner. So that's really cool news in terms of moving our federal law away from cruel and human degrading treatment. The torture front is a little less promising with our new CIA director and some other, other details around our recent and long-term history with torture. Anyway, Article 6, everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. 7, all are equal before the law and entitled without any discrimination to equal protection of the law. All are entitled to equal protection against any discrimination in violation of this declaration and against any incitement to such discrimination. 8, everyone has a right to effective remedy. Sorry, the scroll is not scrolling correctly. Effective remedy by the component national tribunals for acts violating the fundamental rights granted them by the Constitution or law. 9, no one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile. 10, everyone is entitled in full equality to a fair and public hearing by an independent and impartial tribunal in the determination of their rights and obligation out of any criminal charge against them. 11, everyone charged with a penal offense has the right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty according to law at a public trial. 12, I'm truncating some of these just in case you're reading along or something at home. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with their privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon their honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to protection of the law against such interference or attacks. 13, everyone has the right to freedom of movement and residence within the borders of each state. 2, everyone has the right to leave any country, including their own, and return to their country. 14, here's an important one for right now. Everyone has the right to seek and enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution. 2, this right may not be invoked in the case of prosecutions genuinely arising from non-political crimes or from acts contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. 15, everyone has the right to a nationality. 16, men and women of full age without any limitation due to race, nationality, or religion have the right to marry and to found a family. They're entitled to equal rights as to marriage during marriage and at its dissolution. Marriage shall be entered into only with the free and full consent of the intending spouses. And the family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state. Ugh. Some language in there that I won't dive into fully, but that's an interesting one. 17, everyone has the right to own property alone as well as in association with others. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of their property. Hello, City of Spokane, at Camp Hope this morning, and the SPD arbitrarily depriving people of their property and throwing it in a dumpster. Looking at you. If you missed the beginning of the show talking about that action at Camp Hope, you have 15 minutes to get down there to City Hall, where there is a rally in support of the protest, the ongoing protest led by people experiencing homelessness and their advocates at 5 at City Hall tonight. Also open forum during the city council meeting. Just a quick plug for that. 18. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, including freedom to change their religion or belief and practicing religion and belief or lack thereof. 19, everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media, regardless of frontiers. 20, everyone has the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. No one may be compelled to belong to an association. 21, everyone has the right to take part in the government of their country directly or through freely chosen representatives, not frozen representatives. 22, everyone as a member of society has the right to Social Security as entitled to realization through national effort and international cooperation and in accordance with the organization and resources of each state of the economic, social, and cultural rights indispensable for their dignity and free development of their personality. 23, everyone has the right to work. Favorable conditions of work and protection against unemployment. There's some other work-related ones in there. I'm just kind of blasting through. 24, everyone has the right to rest and leisure, including reasonable limitation of working hours and periodic holidays with pay. If only. 25, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of themselves and their family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond their control. 26. Everyone has the right to education. Education shall be free, at least in the elementary and fundamental stages. Elementary education shall be compulsory, technical and professional education shall be made generally available, and higher education shall be equally accessible to all on the basis of merit. 27. Everyone has the right to freely participate in the cultural life of the community, to enjoy the arts, and share in scientific advancement and its benefits. 28. Everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration can be fully realized. 29. Everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full development of their personality is possible. And 30, the final one, nothing in this declaration may be interpreted as implying for any state, group, or person any right to engage in any activity or to perform any act aimed at the destruction of any of the rights and freedoms set forth herein. That one is really interesting, and that is something that's coming up a lot, I think, in this whole debate around emergent, like, overt fascism in our political culture right now in the U.S. and more broadly around the world, and kind of the false equivalence of, you know, aren't anti-fascists the real fascists? Ooh, you know, and the argument that, you know, expressions of hate groups are mere free speech. That this final article really gets at that issue, that you can't use your rights to curtail the rights of others, and that kind of cancels out this whole project of human rights. It only works if they're available to everyone, and you know that the same goes for concepts of tolerance and the rest, and that, you know, as Loretta Ross said in the interview that I shared, we do need to engage with one another across ideas and across ideology, and not become, as she said, a cult rather than a movement. But, you know, where are the limits to that? I think there are limits to that. And that's a rich conversation that's been going on. So anyway, those are kind of, that's just the basics of what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights are. I'm sure listening to those, you can probably hear in my tone of voice also the some of the contradictions that are present there. And interestingly enough, I don't have time to share the bulk of it with you today, but Human Rights Watch does an annual report, and they do many reports, obviously. They do a world, like, state of human rights around the world, but the United States report specifically is focused on 2017. I'm sure there will be a 2018 report soon as the year comes to a close, but they kind of pinpoint what are the main human rights violations in this country. And just on the headlines here, I'll share this link to this report in the podcast notes, because I think it's interesting to read and kind of a reality check, you know, if you need one of those in these days. But the things they point to specifically are harsh criminal sentencing, racial disparities in the criminal justice system, drug policy and policing, youth in the criminal justice system, poverty and criminal justice, the rights of non-citizens, and that's a bulky section in this report, the right to health, the rights of people with disabilities, women's and girls' rights, sexual orientation and gender identity, national security, surveillance, an interesting one that fades into the background a lot, freedom of expression and assembly, and foreign policy. So again, that's a Human Rights Watch report, and I'll share the link because I think it's interesting. So if you want to see that link, if you missed any of the show and you want to hear it, you can go either to kyrs.org and find my show page, Praxis. You can also go directly, you can search Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, on iTunes, Google Play, and all the rest. Or you can go directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio and find the feed there. So, I'm going to close with a speech from that might make you, I'm not really into, like, waxing poetic about presidents or people of the past, and a lot of that's been going on with kind of an unworthy with George H.W. Bush. But I thought this was a good, this is a speech from Eleanor Roosevelt, who was, you know, first lady at the time of, in the time of the adoption of this declaration. And I think it's interesting to hear her talk about human rights from her perspective. So I'm just going to close with that speech and get out of here. So I'll be gone next week, but I pre-recorded a show I'm excited about with Autumn and Kevin, hosts of Just Us, who you can hear KYRS on Sundays. You'll hear that next week, and then I'll be back during the holidays. So thanks for listening. And yeah, here is that speech from Eleanor.
I'm very glad to be able to take part in this celebration in St. Louis on Human Rights Day. Ever since the Declaration of Human Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, was passed in Paris in 1948 on December the 10th, we have fostered the observance of this day, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. The object is to make people everywhere conscious of the importance of human rights and freedoms. The reason for that is that these are spoken of and emphasized in the Charter of the United Nations, and the Declaration was written to elaborate the rights already mentioned in the Charter and to emphasize also for all of us the fact that the building of human rights would be one of the foundation stones on which we would build in the world an atmosphere in which peace could grow. For that reason, all over the world, we've encouraged the associations for the United Nations to observe a whole week before United Nations Day comes around to explain United Nations and what goes on in that organization. And when we come to the celebration for human rights, we try to particularly have people study the Declaration so that they will really understand what were considered to be the most essential rights for all people to have throughout the world. They fall into different groups, and one reason that we are now considering the writing of a covenant or covenants is because we feel that these rights should sometime be actually written into the laws of countries throughout the world. And that can be done by the adoption of covenants and the changing of laws to meet whatever a country has accepted in a covenant, which will be written in treaty form. These things must be well understood, because even though you accept treaties and countries ratify those treaties, the real change which must give to people throughout the world their human rights must come about in the hearts of people. We must want our fellow human beings to have rights and freedoms which give them dignity and which will give them a sense that they are human beings that can walk the earth with their heads high and look all men in the face. If we observe these rights for ourselves and for others, I think we will find that it is easier in the world to build peace, because war destroys all human rights and freedoms. So in fighting for those, we fight for peace.
a public service announcement with guitar.